Let's move on to the next portion of the course, which is habitat management, wetland management. So over today and Thursday, we'll be covering management of wetlands and associated upland areas for different wetland species. Okay. Usually when we're managing wetlands, in fact, the field of wetland management really was born out of the field of waterfowl ecology and management. And much of wetland management focuses around managing for waterfowl. We will talk about two other groups that now are often considered in managing wetlands, and that is shorebirds and amphibians. We'll focus mostly on waterfowl. John's already touched on shorebirds, and if you're interested in amphibians, you can take amphibian ecology and conservation next semester, offered at both the undergrad and graduate level. But we will touch on those. We're not going to ignore those groups. Okay. Before you can really begin to think about, let me get my presentation up here. Okay. Before you manage anything, the first step is understanding what those organisms need and what they're doing. That's the first step in wildlife management. So, as I mentioned, we have three groups that we're going to focus our efforts on, at least take into consideration. We have waterfowl. We have shorebirds, and for those that are at home, I'm writing these on the board. And we have amphibians. All right. Now, what I would like for us to first do is to identify life cycle events that we should be considering and what they need for each of these groups. Okay, so let's start with waterfowl. Okay, and let's think about what ducks are doing throughout the annual cycle, throughout the year. So let's list some activities here. All right, so what are ducks doing? Let's go, guys. Huh? Well, yeah, I mean, let's start right now. So what are they doing right now? They're migrating, right? So we have, basically, we have fall migration. Okay. When they're here, what are they doing? Foraging, feeding, acquiring food resources, etc. What else? Yeah, there are molting activities that go on at times of the year. They replace feathers. All birds replace their feathers. Ducks actually replace their go through two molts, replace other body feathers twice, wing feathers once. Talk about that in just a second. So they molt. What else do ducks do?
Breed.
They breed. And the consequence, hopefully, of breeding is nesting. And hopefully the consequence of nesting is?
Fledging.
Is what?
Fledging.
Yeah, fledgling. Yeah, but we call it brood rearing in the waterfowl world. Is your offspring, raising your offspring. Okay. So we have fall migration. Fall migration, of course, once they're down here, they need to head back. So spring migration is also included in there. We're replacing feathers, etc. All right. Good. Now, let's think about shorebirds. What are shorebirds doing? They're migrating as well, right? Oh, no, no, there's still some migrating now. Oh, yeah, still some coming in. Migrating, they stay over winter, they fly back to southern United States, or northern United States, southern Canada, up to northern Canada, and they breed and basically fledge their offspring. Okay. And then amphibians. What about amphibians? They can breed all year long. As far as the different species, for the most part, breeding is concentrated from the period of April through July, although there is breeding that occurs earlier and some breeding that occurs in the fall. Okay. So breeding, and then outside of breeding, there are some concerns that we should think about with respect to migration, basically terrestrial habitats. Yeah, that can be important too, connection of water sources, of breeding sites. Okay. All right. So if we want to begin to think about, we have these different activities that are up there, that are going on, and we want to think about how we're going to be managing for these groups. We really need to think about when they're doing these throughout the annual cycle. And I didn't mean to give you guys this because I don't want you all sitting there and just looking at this, because this is the first time I did this, because I always write it on the board because it's important that you write it down and understand it. If you just look at it, you'll never remember it. The only reason I did this is because we have people listening that unfortunately can't watch everything I write. So that's what I'm moving to next, which is basically talking about what these different events are that these groups are doing throughout the annual cycle. Then we'll talk about is that the outline indicates what the waterfowl diet, what management complex, moist soil management, etc. So whenever you're managing, okay, you always want to think about your animals, whether it's quail or deer or ducks. You want to think about them throughout the annual cycle. So I'm drawing right now for those at home a timeline, and you can see that on the slides, basically going from January to January, but January through December. And the center, about right in here, is June. Okay. Okay, so I've got a timeline broken up into January, June in the center, and then December. All right, so let's start with, where do we want to start? Since we're dealing with sort of right now, why don't we talk about right now? And we have September. September is the beginning of the season. We'll start with waterfowl, the group waterfowl. So it's the beginning of migration. And birds, ducks will start arriving in our area in September. Certain species, primarily blue-winged teal. So from September really through December, we have fall migration going on. okay? Fall migration. Okay. Once winter hits down here in about November, things start getting cold, and the birds need to keep warm, and so we need to think about different things we can do to manage for the birds so that they can efficiently maintain their body temperature. Okay? So we have thermal regulation that is an interest and a concern. Okay? And that pretty much runs all the way through February, or even farther. Okay? All right. Well, if we go full circle from starting in about March, then, from March until April, we have spring migration. Okay? And that's what you see up there from March until April. Once the birds are back on the breeding grounds, then the males are competing for territory sites, for breeding sites, and for breeding and nesting. And that's from April through March. Well, that's about the same time, right, when they're arriving. Okay? Then the females are nesting usually through June. And they're not nesting for that entire time. Usually they're nesting for about a month. But different individuals and different species will start nesting early April and then even later into the year. Okay? About a month after nesting, so starting in about May and going through July, the females are raising their broods. Okay? After the hen begins to nest, just to take a step back here, for ducks, the males leave. And they form bachelor groups. Which they'll stay in to go through molting. For geese and swans and whistling ducks, they stay with the hens and they help guard the nest. Okay. Now going from May, again through July, we have a period of time when they are molting. Now the molting that's going on, there are two different molts. One is the pre-basic molt And that's what's going on during this period of time. They're getting their what's called eclipse plumage. For males, they do a full body molt and a wing molt. For females, they only do a wing molt.
He wants to know what sex is molting what.
Yeah, hell yeah, of course. Yeah, why would I be saying it otherwise? Okay. All right. Now, why is that the case? Why are females just doing a wing molt? Huh?
Well, are males going to have more brightly colored plumage during the breeding season?
Yeah.
They don't necessarily need that for winter?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a good point from an evolutionary standpoint, thinking that basically most females are crippled and hence replacing their body feathers are not that important in comparison to males, which if you are flightless, you don't want to stand out like a sore thumb. So that certainly could be actually a driving evolutionary factor. Another very likely consequence too, which is driven by physiology, is in order to build feathers, you need protein. And at this time, hens have expended a tremendous amount of energy and protein in building eggs. And so they are nutritionally deficient. So that is likely another reason. Okay.
I know they base a lot of it off of mallards. Do you know if it's similar for all other dabbling ducks? Or do you have an idea on that? I was just curious.
Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So again, swinging back around, once we get into July through September, when birds start to begin to be able to fly again, including the ducklings start to be able to fly, then the males and females start to get together and form gregarious flocks and get ready for migration. Okay. Now, from August through October, hens are going through their pre-basic body molt. Okay. Okay, so they're picking up their body molt when they're migrating. Males in September through November do what is called their pre-alternate molt, which is their second molt, which is only a body molt. And this gives them their breeding plumage. Okay. If you ever harvest a bird, a duck in early October, if you're up in the northern latitudes, it's still often in its pre-basic plumage, its eclipse plumage. Then hens, will do their pre-alternate molt later on in the year, December through January. Okay? That's just, again, a body molt. Now, if we superimpose on top of here, so these are all pretty much all the activities that are occurring for waterfowl throughout the annual cycle. And if we superimpose on top of here what shorebirds are doing, at least with respect to migrating, when is migration occurring for shorebirds? Yeah, mid to late July through November. The species composition is changing. So we're going from, I wonder if that's a permit. No, it isn't. Through November. Okay, we have shorebirds that are migrating. With peak shorebird migration occurring in our latitudes during August and September. Okay? When are most anurans, or amphibians, excuse me, breeding? Yeah, March through July for amphibians. Going from March through July. Okay. And there are certainly some amphibians that breed January through March. And most of the ambystomid salamanders are also breeding at this time. Mole salamanders. And then there are some anurans. Okay. So those are all of our activities overlapped. And then I guess there is spring migration as well for shorebirds. For the most part, though, even though you can't see it down there, but you can see it on the handout, fall migration is considered the most limiting time for shorebirds. Okay? And the reason is because there's less water in the landscape. All right? Any questions? Now, if we overlap this, okay, for our period of time, then we can start to begin to formulate management recommendations and think about what we need to do at certain times. So for non-resident waterfowl, as far as when we need to be thinking about in the southeast and managing for them, that is September through basically March of the following year. If we think about our nesting waterfowl, which are wood ducks and hooded mergansers, our nesting waterfowl are nesting from April through June, with the females, again, brood rearing from May through July. Okay? Amphibians, again, as we talked about, they're breeding for the most part March through July. And the species composition changes a lot. Ones that are breeding in March very rarely breeding in July. Okay? We need to think about when we are managing for amphibians, it's not just providing breeding habitat. Many of them have a larval stage, and it takes usually 1 to 2 months for those larvae to develop and go through metamorphosis. So this is the breeding time. There are species, your summer breeding species, that are breeding in June and July. If you drain the water in an area that you're providing breeding habitat for amphibians, their larvae are not going to survive, those summer breeders, okay? You'll dry them up and when you draw down water. Okay, so you need to think about the lag with respect to just like we're thinking about the lag with respect to ducks nesting and producing offspring and females brood rearing, same thing for the amphibians, where really going into September, some of these summer breeders will be going through metamorphosis. One species in particular will even overwinter, which is the American bullfrog, and also green frogs will overwinter. So some permanently flooded areas, if you're interested in providing habitat for those species, should be provided. Yeah, so that's another good one. Marbled salamanders, which is a type of ambistomid salamander, maculatum, is that right? Or is that spotted? Opacum, yeah, opacum. Ambistoma opacum is just starting to breed now when it rains. So if you're interested in providing habitat for ambistomatid salamanders, which is usually more ephemeral forested wetlands, we'll get to that in just a second, you might take them into consideration. There are only, really are only fall breeding ambistomata. Most of them are breeding during this period of time, early in the year, January through March. And then there are a whole variety of other species, plethodontid salamanders, etc., which are breeding anywhere from really April through the summer. Okay, what else do we have? We have spring migration of shorebirds, which we should think about and take into consideration, and fall migrants. All these things, why am I mentioning these? Well, first of all, in order to manage a wetland, you need to think of all these things simultaneously. You need to be providing for these animal groups at the same time. Not every single wetland that you have can be managed for all these simultaneously. So you need to think about how you're going to put together different strategies to manage for different groups. And if you're fortunate enough to have more than one wetland, which usually most of our WMAs or federal refuges or whatever, usually have more than one wetland in a complex, then you can address management of multiple species. Okay, if we look in Tennessee, when is our least amount of activity? In other words, when do the fewest number of these lines overlap? That is during basically March and during August. And during this period of time, though, again, you is a critical period for providing shorebird habitat in August and in March. Again, the beginning of providing amphibian habitat and also spring migration of waterfowl and shorebirds is beginning in here. So things to kind of think about. Okay? All right. So let's move on to the next aspect of management. One of the things in management, especially in the Southeast, is providing food resources for waterfowl, particularly migrating wintering waterfowl. We have a lecture on management of breeding waterfowl, so I won't touch too much on that today. Okay, so one of the primary things that we're doing in managing for migrating wintering waterfowl is providing food resources. Why? Because there are lots of energetically demanding type activities, as well as some activities, such as some of the molting that's going on, that is relatively protein demanding. So overall, what do ducks eat? What are their primary food items?
Inverts.
Yeah, the inverts, as well as?
Acorns.
Yeah, seeds, acorns, moist soil seeds, plant seeds, etc. And then some are specialists, as we talked about before. The diving ducks will eat some will eat vegetation exclusively, or fish. Most of the dabbling ducks, though, are eating inverts and seeds. Okay, now if we think about breaking this down in what they're eating throughout the annual cycle, Pre-laying, each of these represents, the white represents inverts, and the maroon represents seeds in the diet. And you can see just prior to laying, this is actually for female mallards, there is a high percentage of aquatic invertebrates that are being consumed. That increases, especially right during laying, to nearly 75% of the diet, again, during laying. And if we look at what's going on during this period of time, pre-laying, laying, of course we have egg production, which is a very protein-demanding activity, which aquatic invertebrates are high in. We also have molting that just after laying will begin. And again, we have the pre-basic molt. Again, hens are just going through the wing molt, but also the males would be going through in a full molt, which again is a very protein-demanding activity. In addition, the ducklings themselves, once they're hatched, are needing high protein resources for growth. Okay? So lots of protein for growth, for development. So these, again, what they need are lots of protein. So during this period of time that we're talking about, from basically April through July, this entire period here, I would write this down, April through July, is a period of that you should be providing, making sure that for breeding waterfowl, if you're managing for those, there are proteinaceous foods that are available. You're providing habitats that have lots of aquatic inverts. Okay? April through July. All right. And that doesn't matter if you're managing for wood ducks or you're managing for mallards. Post-laying, again, what we talk about post-laying as far as this research is concerned, we're talking about July, during this period of staging and into migration. So from July, or basically August into the fall. And we see hen mallards and most other species switching their diets mostly to seeds, very high seeds that are high in carbohydrates. And when you get into winter, so once they've pretty much completed migration, they're down in our area from November, December into January, their diet is primarily composed of seeds. And again, if we think about the different life activities we have going on during this period, that group of time from September, well, August through March of the following year, they have fall migration going on, very highly energetic. That's one other thing we haven't put up there. Courtship. When does courtship occur? Pair bonding. Yeah, it's occurring. Basically, they start doing courtship flights, etc., even in November. But it really picks up later in the winter, so we have pair bonding going on. Okay, going all the way through February. So this is when the pair bonds are being formalized. And there will be some pair bonding still going on in the breeding grounds, but for the most part, it occurs on the winter grounds when they're doing courtship activities. Very energetic process. Thermal regulation, maintaining their body temperatures, and then you have spring migration heading back to the breeding ground. So very energetically associated activities from August through March. So when we think about managing for waterfowl, in our area, outside of managing for maybe wood ducks during the breeding season or hooded mergansers, we're thinking about providing high energy resources. And yes, still some protein, because there is molting that is going on. Okay? So with respect to protein and carbohydrates, seeds are extremely high in carbohydrates as far as energy is concerned, and invertebrates are very high in protein. Invertebrates also do have pretty high energy value as well. Okay? Good? All right. Yeah, I guess the last note on the bottom is the pre-alternate molt, don't forget that. It is important not to just provide energy-rich resources during migration and in the winter time. Okay, during fall and winter for waterfowl. You need to have areas where birds can acquire aquatic inverts, because it's not the only thing they need. They still need aquatic inverts. Okay? Is that clear? Good. Aquatic inverts. All right. So when we think about managing for water birds and amphibians in the southeast, our resident waterfowl, our wood ducks, and hooded mergansers, which are cavity nesting species. We'll get into this a little bit more later on. So we need cavity trees. We need brood rearing habitat that is high, that supports aquatic invertebrate populations, and also provides protection from predators. And we'll talk about the different predators that commonly predate wood ducks. Again, protein-rich foods, and we're focusing our activities for the most part April through July. Yes. Yes, they are. Yeah, they're going through migration or going through molting at the same time. Yeah, they still molt. They still replace their body and wing feathers. Yeah. Okay, resident amphibians, we're again providing, as I mentioned earlier, breeding habitat and larval habitat. For managing for amphibians, we want to provide semi-permanent water sources, as well as, and ideally without fish, as well as ephemeral vernal pools, typically in a forested environment. And those are very important sites for various types of salamanders, like this spotted salamander. Okay, for the most part, amphibians are breeding April through July. That's the majority of the species. Although, again, there are salamanders like this ambistomid salamander that are breeding earlier. And again, this is the breeding season. So we really should be providing larval habitat through September. Okay? All right. So yeah, I guess January through April, we have several other species. Again, providing some habitat for mole salamanders and for many of the frog species, the early breeding species, like southeastern chorus frogs and spring peepers is important. All right, for migratory waterfowl, again, we've already talked about this, high energy foods. We're going to be providing moist soil wetlands. We'll talk exactly about what that is. Freshwater marshes, again, these are areas, freshwater marshes that will be high in aquatic inverts, as well as agriculture some agricultural resources because those are very high in energy, agricultural grains are. We also want to provide some forested wetlands for migratory waterfowl because those areas are important areas for them to get in and get out of the weather, for thermal regulation, for protection from predators, to acquire aquatic inverts, and also for pair bonding. So all those activities. And again, September through February, early March is when we're focusing our management efforts on those. For shorebirds, again, John talked about primary diets of shorebirds being aquatic invertebrates. Most shorebirds do not like vegetation, like open, wide mud flats, and we want to provide for migratory shorebirds, at least fall migration, we want to especially focus on late July through November, okay, providing habitat for those. So most of the species that migrate through our region are migrating through in August and September. Ah, there you go. There's a shorebird quiz. It wasn't? Oh, yeah, you guys should know it. Okay, stilt sandpipers. And that one was? Yeah, lee sandpiper. Okay, and again, August and September. All right, so in order to manage for all of these different groups, the only way we can do that, was it that? Yeah, I guess it was. Is through managing what wetland ecologists call a management complex. Okay, so we can think about our habitat complex including lots of different things. The first being moist soil wetlands, then we have forested wetlands, we have agriculture, and then we also want to provide a fourth component over here, flooded marshes, and a fifth component that we need, that we should always have in managing, is especially for hunted species, is for any species, is some type of refugia. Okay, so there should be areas that basically the public is not allowed to go into, and create disturbance. Especially for our migratory birds, shorebirds, and waterfowl. Okay. All right. The rule of thumb as far as how much area refuge should cover within a particular WMA or or a refuge, National Wildlife Refuge, is 1/3 of the area that you have. Now, if you have a small area, that's a test question. I'd write that down. Okay. If your area is small and you have surrounding areas, WMAs, you can use one WMA as refuge and the surrounding areas as open for public use for hunting. Okay, so let's go ahead and roll into management of moist soil wetlands. I have for waterfowl here, but we'll probably be touching on all the groups. So, as part of your reading, waterfowl use of wetland complexes, this is required reading here. Make sure you read over that. The second handout is showing an example of a state management area in Michigan. And to get you thinking about providing lots of different types of wetland types for water birds. So I just want to point out here This big part in the center that is numbered 112 through 171 is all a forested wetland area. You can see right in the center of the refuge then, they have a wildlife refuge, or the I should call it WMA. They have a wildlife refuge. There's no access. That is entirely freshwater marsh wetlands, like persistent emergent wetlands. The areas that you see that have lines basically through them and lots of numbers are all flooded cropland areas, agriculture. And then up to the far right, you have some units up here, A through E, F through K. Those units there are all freshwater marshes. Right through the center of this state game area, they also have a river that comes through that provides riverine habitat. So there's lots of different components to this particular refuge and or state game area, excuse me. And that's what you need to be kind of thinking about when you're managing for migratory water birds, is managing a complex with several different different components. Okay? All right. Now, the next handout, the backside of that handout we'll get to in a little bit, deals with hemi marshes. The next handout is required reading. Make sure you read through this and pretty much just commit it to memory. Outside of, obviously, I give some numbers here about different pieces of equipment, which we'll talk about as far as how much they cost. I mean, you don't know, you need to know that, but you should know all the way through, but not including part three. Part three says evaluating management, computing duck use days, which is on second to the last page. That we will cover for test three. But everything else we're going to go through today. And we'll, again, you don't need to know the evaluating the management. We're just talking about managing wetlands today. All right. Okay, the next handout I'll get to in just a moment. So, what are moist soil wetlands? Well, moist soil wetlands can be generally defined as intermittently to seasonally flooded wetlands that are dominated by annual or perennial herbaceous hydrophytes. All right, that's all nice and dandy. Okay, they kind of look like this. They're seasonally flooded wetlands, and I'm just saying this very general right now, because I want us to actually use the knowledge that we've developed to talk about what those are within the context of the corn classification system. So we are in the palustrine system when we're talking about moist soil wetlands. What is the subsystem for palustrine? There isn't one, right? Okay, what's the class, excuse me? The class we're in is emergent wetland when we're dealing with moist soil wetlands. There are two subclasses. What are those? Persistent and non-persistent. So we have persistent wetlands and non-persistent wetlands. Now for persistent wetlands, usually these are, again, you have cattail over here, you have species that are in the genus some of the scirpuses, some of the juncuses are persistent. You may have some vines that are in there as well. Over here, non-persistent, these are annual grasses that are toppling over at the end of the growing season. Various types of sedges, carex and cyperus, grasses, panic grasses, millets, echinocloa, etc. So you have annual grasses. Now, usually if you have a persistent emergent wetland, these species are your perennial hydrophytes. They are primarily reproducing vegetatively via rhizomes by sending up tillers. On the non-persistent side, these are mostly annual plants, and they're producing seed. So if we're interested in producing seed, which side do you think we want to be on? Yeah, we want to be on the right side, okay? We want to be producing non-persistent if we're interested in producing lots of seed for migratory water birds. Okay? It happens that on the left side here with persisting emergent wetlands, usually they represent a later stage of succession, where on the right side, non-persistent, is an earlier stage of succession. Therefore, we can use management to maintain that early stage of succession. Okay, and there are a couple different things we can do. We can use water, hydrologic management, and the other is mechanical manipulations, and then to some degree some other types of techniques. All right, so this is fundamental to managing wetlands, is that as far as managing wetlands for migratory waterfowl, we want to be on the right side of this graph in producing annual plants. Why again? Because it is all connected back to the needs of the birds at this time. Now, it tends to be that these, if you flood these areas up with the perennial plants, they tend to be very robust as far as they have lots of vegetation, leaf area, lots of vegetative biomass, etc. That's what they're putting all their energy in. They aren't putting it into seed. So things again like different types of rushes, smartweed is another one that's very leafy. It doesn't produce a whole lot of seed. Some species of smartweeds, polygonums, produce a little more seed than others. They tend to be towards the later successional stage wetlands. They are a persistent plant. But when you flood these areas up, because of that, lots of that leaf biomass, they tend to be pretty good as far as producing aquatic inverts. So having some of those sites is good, with the primary idea and focus that you are producing those areas, or you're managing those areas for aquatic invertebrate production. Lastly, just to come down here to put the water regime on here, anywhere from intermittently flooded to seasonally flooded is the typical water regime, for moist soil areas. So what is seasonally flooded? Do you guys remember what that means? Seasonally flooded pretty much has water until close towards the end of the growing season, then it dries up. So we're on this continuum of not being flooded for very long to pretty much being flooded just towards the kind of the end of the growing season. All right. So we have that's the definition of a moist soil wetland. Obviously, emergent wetlands, persistent, non-persistent, exist without us managing them. If we put levees around them, then we have a moist soil unit. And our idea of putting levees around them is to control the hydrology within that wetland. So here's a moist soil unit on the bottom left. General rule of thumb is you want them less than 100 acres in size, or 40 hectares in size. It's better to have them small, a lot smaller than that. That's the maximum size you want them. You should not be flooding more than 3 to 4 1-foot contours. Okay? I guess you remember that, won't you? Okay, good. I didn't see anybody writing anything down. All right. Okay, so the maximum you want to be flooding is 3 to 4 1-foot contours. Why is that the case?
By that point, you're getting beyond what is that reach.
That's right. That's exactly right. We're getting beyond the foraging ability depth of most of our waterfowl species. And ideally, for waterfowl, they want it less than 2 foot deep. You want it shallow. Okay, but what it's often difficult to find areas that are really, really flat so that you can't flood more than 4 usually you're going to flood 3 to 4 contours. If you want an area that's a decent size and manageable, it just becomes extremely tedious to have, literally, if you have 50 units that you're having to manage the water in. So usually you have larger areas, a little bit larger areas, you know, and so usually you're covering more than a couple contours, although you could put low-level contour levees up just with a rice plow or something to help do some management within really large impoundments. So when we put all these things together, a group of interconnected moist soil impoundments that can be managed independently, we have what is called a moist soil management complex. And these are all moist soil wetlands. This is an example of these numbers represent different impoundments. And one important thing, source of being effective, or one important component of a management complex is, in order to manage these water levels, you should have a permanent water source. And what this arrow is pointing to is actually a reservoir here that allows water to flow on into this complex and down a distribution channel, which is right in the center and allows the managers here to push water into each of these impoundments independently. And for the guys that were down at Noxubee last year, that's Ross Branch Reservoir that we opened up and let the water go into. Okay, so having a permanent water source really gives you, and this is all gravity flow, which is really nice. It doesn't cost any money to basically open up a gate and let water flow into those units. Okay. Any questions? All right, so let's talk about managing managing the water levels within moist soil units. There are different types of drawdowns. They have to do with the timing of the drawdown and the rate in which they're drawn down. So you can have an early drawdown or a spring drawdown. And for an early drawdown, for the rate of the drawdown, you can have a fast drawdown, which is 2 to 3 days, or you can have a slow drawdown, which goes over a couple weeks. So you have spring drawdown the drawdown spring just means to taking the water out of these impoundments. So you're having these things flooded up until the birds are usually leaving. And again, let's see here. You can bring that water out fast or you can bring it out slow. For all cases, you want to bring it out slow. You have a problem with respect to flooding conditions, things that are a concern, you have a levee that's broken, or you have that's busted, or you have a water control structure that's malfunctioned, you always want to bring it down slow from a biological perspective. And why is that? Slow drawdowns create greater plant diversity and they consolidate food resources. So as you're slowly bringing that water down, you have aquatic invertebrates that are becoming concentrated within the remaining water. Also, as soil is exposed, you have different plants germinating, seed germinating, and it increases over this 2 to 3, even 4 week drawdown, you'll have different species responding. An increase in plant diversity usually corresponds directly to an increase in nutritional diversity, which is a good thing for birds. Now, we can talk about date, which is an early drawdown, or late, which is later fall, well, closer towards fall. So early drawdown is April, late drawdown is July. I wouldn't go much later than July. You could go into August. You need about 2 months of growing season for moist soil plants to respond. Your annual grasses can germinate and grow and reach senescence, produce seed within 2 months. Later drawdowns usually result in greater production of annual plants. Okay, there's just not enough time for the species that are reproducing vegetatively to put up rhizomes, etc. You give your annuals a competitive advantage by drawing down late. So this is a way that you can help, you can manage cereal succession with just a drawdown, okay? There are issues with that, in that if you have a perennial dominated wetland system, by holding the water late until the following year, you'll probably have some annuals responding, but you probably need to get in there and do some other type of manipulation. The late drawdown is best when you are already in an early successional state. The late successional, once you get towards a later successional state, many of the perennial breeding species also have allelopathic capabilities and inhibit the germination of annual grasses. So if there's still litter that's hanging around of these perennial plants because you're in late succession, it can inhibit the germination of your annuals. Okay. The other thing that a late drawdown does do is it provides some habitat for, again, amphibians, and it provides habitat for breeding ducks, for brood-rearing ducks. Okay, so that's another reason to have a late drawdown. Now, slow drawdowns should always be done, but you should have a combination of early and late drawdowns. And we can talk about more details later. In particular, I'll just mention this right now, early drawdowns probably, if you're getting to a late successional state, you probably should draw down early so that you can get in there and do some type of mechanical manipulation. Let the soils dry out and be able to get in there and do a mechanical manipulation. Okay. The other thing is that early drawdowns also, if you're drawing down in March, April, you're providing some habitat for those spring migrants, the shorebirds that are migrating back through. And so that provides some habitat if you do have an impoundment that's being drawn down in the spring. One thing you need to be aware of and cognizant of is what's been coined an ecological trap. If you start pulling the water out of there in July and you have wood ducks that are using, wood duck broods that are using those sites, you're going to force them to leave. And when wood ducks or any little duckling starts taking off across a terrestrial landscape, their probability of getting across it tends to be pretty low. The other thing is this also is true for again, amphibians that are breeding. If you have your summer breeders that are breeding in July, June and July, there's no way if you start drawing it down that their tadpoles are going to be far along in development to be able to go through metamorphosis, and you'll have a bunch of dried up tadpoles. Of course, if you have herons around, they may like that. So it depends on if that's part of your management scheme. Okay. It's good to have multiple combinations. Again, always slow, unless, again, you have a levee break or something deals with logistics, and then have a combination of late and early. Now, irrigation may be necessary. If you have the capabilities, you may want to use it. Like this year would be a year that you would want to have used, you would want to have irrigated, because what will happen is moist soil plants are very adaptive to dealing with wet conditions and dry conditions. But if you had a drawdown in early or late drawdown, and with as dry as it's been, those plants will grow and germinate, grow very quickly and produce seed, and not a whole lot of seed. and the seed will drop off and it'll sit there, and you won't have a very high seed production. And as that seed is sitting there, maybe late summer, there's a lot of time that it can sit there, it can regerminate, or it can be eaten by other wildlife, etc., and not be available for the target group that you're focusing on, such as waterfowl. So if you have the capability, like you have a permanent water source, like a reservoir or a river, that you can flood shallowly, and we're literally talking like just, you know, less than 4 inches of water is ideal. Okay, that can really, really help and give a boost to your moist soil plants and help them get through drought stress. And again, usually it doesn't take very long. You just put that water on there for 2 to 3 weeks, and that gives them a boost and allows them to increase their growth and increase their seed production. You do not want to overtop your plants. If you overtop moist soil plants, for the most part, you're going to kill them if they're overtop for more than about 7 days. So you want to make sure you keep an eye on if you're irrigating. Make sure you're not flooding it too deep. For winter, for flooding up in the winter to provide habitat, again, always flood slow. And what I call sequential. So when we talk about this management complex, assuming you have more than one impoundment, you don't want to flood all your impoundments up in at the same time. Okay? Our birds start flying through here, as far as ducks are concerned, start flying through in September. It's good to put some water out there in September. And then you can follow up with another unit being flooded, depending on how many you have, in October, maybe one in November. Majority of our birds are arriving in December and January. So you would definitely want to hold off and keep maybe the majority of your impoundments and wait to flood those in November, December, and January. But you do want to think about those early migrants that are coming through in September and October. Usually the winter flooding, you're flooding moist soil habitat. Again, it's going to be persistent vegetation this tall. So, or non-persistent or persistent vegetation that's a meter tall. You're usually, when you're winter flooding, you're not providing habitat for shorebirds. They're not going to be jumping around in that tall vegetation. So when you think about managing for shorebirds in the fall, you want to be thinking about drawing down, actually holding the water there all through summer, and then drawing down, you know, in July, late July. And again, you can still have plants that are germinating and grow, and you can flood those up later in the year into maybe November, December. And the ones that you had an early drawdown, you can actually flood earlier in the year because they've had an opportunity to develop plants. Does that seem clear to y'all? Okay. We can brainstorm about different ways we might do this. In fact, y'all have a scenario here that we'll talk about later on. Okay. In fact, I want you all to think, we'll get to that in just a little bit, but I want you all to think about this and come back with ideas on Thursday, okay, and think about what you might do. All right, always flood shallowly. I have here, basically 5 inches to 10 inches. Again, that's not normally you normally can't do that because your impoundments are a little bit larger. But you can flood up nice and slow so that you're basically always got you have a portion of your moist soil unit that is within this nice shallow depth range. And as it gets deeper and deeper, and you just bring that water up slower and slowly, even the deeper areas can be used by other birds, such as your diving ducks, if it's not covered with too much vegetation. Or it can be used for roosting. Geese will roost in it, and other ducks. Those deeper water areas also will start to have good invertebrate populations. Okay, so September. All right. So let's talk about going through these techniques here. Show you some pictures, and give you an illustration of what we're talking about. We'll talk about these different things in a little more detail, but these pictures just kind of show you and illustrate a drawdown. This is a water control structure here, drop board water control structure, which I'll have some pictures of later. You're pulling the boards out sometime in the spring or the summer. Water comes rushing out on the other side of a levee. Okay, so this is on one side of a levee where you have water backed up into the pondment. This is your drain pipe. It's going through the levee, and out it goes to usually, you know, some permanent water source. And then you have exposed mud flats. This is what shorebirds like. So again, providing this in the spring, during spring migration in April and May, you're going to have shorebirds using that. And then later on in August and September, providing some of those habitats are important. Then seed that is within that seed bank of those moist soil, of those mud flats, germinates once soil temperature gets up high enough, and it results in growth of moist soil plants. And what you want generally for the most part are annual grasses and sedges. You may need an irrigate, like you can see us doing here down in Mississippi and during a drought. And ideally you want to flow water in, but you could also pump it in. This is just a long plastic distribution flexible tube that is water is being pumped down. This is actually out in Texas here, irrigating a Playa Lake, which is a type of moist soil wetland. So the vegetation responds. This is what you want to see. You want to see lots of annual plants with, you can see the seed heads here, okay, producing lots of seed. And this would be a good example of an early successional wetland. Again, you don't even need to know what those are. If you see big seed heads, it's a good thing. All right. So as you get later into succession, you start to get perennial plants. Again, the persistent plants. If you're out there, if you put water on these things and you're out there in February, what you're looking at is still the plants. The plants haven't toppled over. Your grasses and stuff topple over, and you'll just see open water. Okay, so early to mid succession, late succession, you start to have obviously some trees coming in, maples, willows, green ash, etc. All right, so this series of photos just kind of illustrates again flowing water down from a permanent water source here. These are a couple reservoirs. You may have huge water control structures in some cases where water is being gravity flowed, and then birds respond, and it's all a good thing. So bird responses can just be fantastic. And the same is the case for shorebirds. I mean, if you bring draw these areas down, it's pretty surprising how quickly birds respond and take advantage of those resources. Okay, our seeds that we're dealing, or our foods that we're dealing with for waterfowl, again, we've already talked about these. You have inverts, seeds, and then tubers are also an important food resource, which again is this portion of the root portion of a perennial plant. And lots of dabbling ducks will eat it, will eat tubers. There is a, let's see, we'll come back to that one. One of the handouts, I guess the next one online, is from John Taylor and Lauren Smith. And they talk about below ground foods for waterfowl. And they talk about actually mallards being important water, rhizomes being an important food source for mallards, but also sandhill crank, etc. This is another required reading, and what I would like for you guys to do is read through this and get ideas about how you would manage water levels, and this will help you in conceiving a management strategy. Okay, all right. What I'm thinking of doing, this is actually, this should look really familiar to you guys. This was on our last test in the spring. But I've done this now for, this is my fourth fall being here. And I've been disappointed every time I've given this. And you know why? Because this is a very, very in-depth damn question. And we're halfway through this lecture, we're not even done talking. So what I think I'm going to do is, I think this is going to be a question for your exam, but I'm going to give it as a take-home question. And this will give you time to formulate all this stuff and assimilate all this stuff. And we can talk about some ideas on Thursday of what you might put in here. So start to think about these, and I think that'll be a fair thing. And we'll like count it for literally like 30 points or something, a major part of your test. And then you can really take your time. And I think that'll help formulate your ideas and think about stuff. If you're a manager, you know, hey, what would I do? This is really almost too comprehensive of a question to give in an exam. So that'll give you time to maybe, you know, think about it over the next week and a half. But, and you can use all these resources, what you're getting from me, plus Lee Fredrickson has a great description here of drawdowns and different. He's really the master when it comes to thinking about managing wetlands for various water birds, and he even talks about some shorebird stuff in here. So, okay, I need to check my time. What's the time? 7 o'clock. Okay, 5 till. Okay, all right. So we're not doing too bad outside of me just being tired right now. I'm sure you guys are tired too. Okay, so we'll go a little bit longer, break in about maybe 15 minutes. Okay, so hydrologic management. There are different types of water control structures, and you're going to see these different structures, well, some of the different structures that exist when we do our field trip out to West Tennessee. All right, one of the first, one of the water control structures, most common type of water control structure, especially when you have a smaller impoundment, is what's called a drop board water control structure. And very appropriate, because these are boards that fall down and drop down into channel iron slots that stop the water from flowing out of an impoundment. And here's your drain pipe. And okay, so this particular structure has a tongue and groove boards, and those are really nice. They fit down pretty well, and they seal up very well. But in talking with some of the biologists that you have used these, if your boards sit in the water, they'll swell up. And if they aren't locked in really good right from the beginning, it can result in your boards popping up. So a lot of folks I've talked to just prefer a nice plain board. And then what they'll do is throw, once you put water in there, it'll be leaking through the boards, there's no doubt. And And it can be pretty substantial leaking. So you can throw sawdust in front of the boards to help clog up those cracks. Or some folks have used black plastic Visqueen to act as a seal. So those are two possibilities that you can use. Here is another type of water control structure. We'll see a lot of these out at Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge. Screw gate water control structures. For the most part, these are a pain in the butt because it requires you to open them and close them. So you have to be running out there and you have to be gauging, you know, how much water is going in and how much water is going out. With the drop board structures, you can measure them at, usually they're about 6 inches high, okay? And so you can put in X number of boards and you know how far it's backing up. Or if you don't know, if it's your first time you're flooding things up, very first fall, you can put half the boards in there and see how far it goes across the landscape and then just keep putting more boards in and letting water flow in. And then simultaneously, it's really nice when you're drawing down because you just pull a board at a time or maybe two boards. So you're just bringing the water down nice and slow as opposed to, you know, you have to, with a screw gate, really keep on top of it. Or next thing you know, everything is drained. Again, we want it to be a nice slow drawdown. So here's another screw gate in the center, water control structure. This is a larger one that's in coastal Louisiana. And so there's lots of different kinds. Another kind is what's called a flap gate water control structure. This is usually done in estuarine systems where when the tide comes in, it allows water to come in, but it does not allow water to go out. So it allows you to trap basically water and hold water in a wetland. Usually what they'll also have is they'll have a screw gate associated with these so they can let water out when the tide goes down if they want to. So moving water, the cheapest way is obviously via gravity. So if you have a reservoir or you have a river or some type of lake or something that you can basically flow water downhill, that's ideal. But there are certainly other ways that you can get water from one place to another. You can use diesel pumps like you can see here, or PTO pumps. You can use electricity. And here's an example of power takeoff pumps that are hooked up to the back of a tractor. There are two brands that are commonly used. One is Crisafoli, the other is Gator. There are websites up there. And basically those hook up to your tractor, up to the power takeoff, spinning drive shaft that ends up turning a propeller. This is back down into this back portion here, down into a permanent water source. And then a flexible tube comes out, goes over a levee, and allows you to pump water from that permanent water source over the levee. Okay? And usually you can pump about 60 feet, 90 feet at most. Each one of these sections of tubing is 30 feet sections, and then there you can connect them with, they have connectors to connect different sections of tubing. But if you get much more than 60 feet, it really, you start to, your efficiency really starts to go down. And the higher your levee is, your efficiency obviously goes down. Okay. It's just another picture there. Here you can see on the left, you can see it back down into the water. Then this is just an illustration here. You can see that flexible tube is pumping water out. You would want to head it over your levee. This is just pumping right back into where you're pumping out. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But okay. I think I have some numbers on the cost of all of these. When we were doing work down in Puerto Rico, I was pricing all this stuff to basically provide management options for the for their natural resource agency. All right. Now, mechanical manipulations. Now, we've talked about using hydrology in some capacity to influence what types of plants respond, with a late drawdown producing more annuals than an early drawdown. But if we really want to affect the state of succession, so to go from persistent emergent to non-persistent emergent, we want to do a mechanical manipulation. This is the most effective method, okay, is mechanical manipulations in comparison to, for example, burning or herbicide. So our primary goal here is to set back succession. And usually in the Southeast, we have to set back succession about every 3 years. It'll start to get into that perennial stage. And we want to think again about when you're managing about rotating. So you don't want to be doing all of your impoundments, have them all in the same successional stage. You want that plant diversity among your impoundments. Some just being manipulated that year, some the following year, some the next year, and then that rotation going. Okay. Spring manipulations are the most common approach, especially in the northern latitudes. And usually you go in and you perform a manipulation immediately after spring drawdown. But in the south, more commonly, folks provide autumn manipulations, and there are several reasons why. Often, you can't perform manipulations earlier because of the Gulf influence. We usually, except for this year, have heavier precipitation than in more northern latitudes. And so we may not be able to get in there with equipment, and also we may want to provide habitat for breeding waterfowl, such as wood ducks or hooded mergansers. Okay? The other thing that can happen, and I'll show you a picture of this, is that because our growing season is longer, if you go in here and even manipulate in the spring, by the fall, the vegetation can grow so dense that if you put water on it, birds will not, many waterfowl species will not be able to land in there and actively acquire those food resources because they prefer a little bit of an open area where they can come in and they can land. So the secondary goal of performing autumn manipulations, one would be to set back succession, and second is to provide waterfowl access. And you can also, in this process, provide habitat for breeding waterfowl, what you can do is do a later drawdown, so you can provide habitat for breeding waterfowl. Now, yeah, just to make a statement right now, but I'll show you some information here in a second. For doing manipulation for setting back succession, disking is the best technique across all of them. Okay, disking is the best technique. Again, why forego mechanical manipulations until autumn? Again, three primary reasons. One is to provide habitat, do a late drawdown. So you probably have habitat for breeding ducks. One is that you can get your tractor stuck because, again, it rains a lot and et cetera. And another reason, again, is dense vegetation can grow up. If you flood that, birds won't be able to access those food resources. So, we looked at different manipulations. Part of my master's work was looking at autumn manipulations and what responded. And we had we looked at disking, mowing, and rototilling, which is not very practical from a large management perspective, but we really wanted to look at a very intense soil disturbance treatment. Okay. And I think I have some results here in a second, I think. So how many disk paths are necessary for disking to be effective? And basically, really as many that is needed, but this is what you want it to look like. I'm going to turn off the light here so you can see that soil. You want it pulverized, quite frankly. Okay, so you do not want to have a whole lot of vegetation. You want it broken up, You want that vegetation incorporated into the soil. And usually it takes 1 to 3 passes with a disc. The later you wait, the farther it gets along the succession, usually the more passes it takes. And this is a good example here on the right side. This is a very late successional wetland, and we've gone over that several times with a disc. And you can see we are not even close to the left side here where you see that bare soil. Okay? So that's what you really need to do. You need to break that soil. You need to expose those seeds and give those plants an opportunity to the seeds, the annual plants, to germinate, etc. Okay. So yeah, this is some results from some of our work that we did. And yeah, let me keep that off actually for a second. You can see pretty good. Mowing and control during the fall didn't change the vegetation. This is smartweed. This is a late, this is swamp smartweed, Plagonum hydropiperoides. So it's very indicative of late succession, especially as you go farther into the south, and doesn't produce very much seed at all. And mowing control, there was no difference in those plots. Disking and tilling, however, you can see a bunch of this lighter color grass here. That's panic grass. This is Cespania. There was some Cespania response. Wasn't too bad, though. So lots of annual grasses and sedges. Basically, when we went in there and we disked and we tilled in the fall, this is the following growing season, what responded. We had an increase in vegetation biomass, which you can obviously see, just that is a hell of a lot taller compared to just that Plagonum monotype. We had an increase in plant species diversity. We had an increase in seed yield. So lots of good things. Now, aquatic inverts were, when we went in there in the fall, okay, and we manipulated the wetland, and we disked it. In the disked and tilled areas that fall, because that vegetation was incorporated soil, aquatic invertebrate production was lower in those than in the control sites. But the following year, that was not the case. So, again, you have higher invertebrate biomass in this area with lots of vegetation. So, doing manipulations in the fall, disking and tilling, and I guess particularly disking because it's just more practical, is a very effective way to set back succession the following growing season. In those disc patched areas, though, just to recap, there won't be a whole lot of aquatic invertebrate production that fall, but the following year there will be, as well as very high seed production. So, plus when you go into these areas and you manipulate again in the fall, you're providing open areas that when it's flooded up, those birds can land, and then they can go into areas that are adjacent that are not manipulated. Another thing, and we'll talk about this, that you want to consider is that when you're performing a mechanical manipulation, you do not want to do the entire impoundment. You want to do parts of the impoundment, either patches or quadrants of an impoundment, just quarters of an impoundment, and set up your grazing or your manipulation schedule based on that. So you're not, again, completely disking an entire area. Okay, well, I think we're pretty much kind of to a point where we can stop today. Any questions, y'all?